Some of the effects produced include levitation of heavy objects. That's very non-trivial. Metal samples turned transparent. Also non-trivial. Metals turned into jelly, and the spontaneous fracturing of metals. The Hutchinson effect has been well documented both on film and videotape and has been witnessed many times by numerous credentialed scientists and engineers. His findings have been televised in the U.S., Japan, and Canada. They've also piqued the interest from electrical engineering aircraft companies, the Canadian Department of Defense, and the military. Some have said John Hutchinson, well, you know, there's a great controversy surrounding him, from those who believe he walks in the shoes of Tesla, to those who believe that it's not repeatable, it's not good science. He has his critics. And now, also this evening, David Sirita. David Sirita's first aspiration in life was to become an astronaut. In 1968, David and a friend witnessed a UFO along with hundreds of other people at the same time. After the experience, David grew up as a UFO enthusiast, never living in doubt of the phenomena that has swept the world since Roswell in 47. His interest in space, religion, philosophy, astronomy, and science led him on his career in related fields. He's worked deeply in high technology, on environmental and humanitarian issues, and as a professional photographer for 20 years. He studied world religion, science, physics, and the paranormal for 25 years. In a moment, John Hutchinson and David Sirita. Stay right there. I'm sure before this night is over, these two are going to solve the world's UFO phenomena question. John Hutchinson and David Sirita. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art. It's a real honor to be on your program.
An honor to have you. And David?
Good to hear your voice again, Art, and all that great music you play.
All right, gentlemen. John, I think that I would like to begin with you. When you are scheduled to be on the air, I get a raft of email, some of it extremely critical of you, and others thinking that, as I mentioned during the opening, that you walk in the shoes of virtually of Tesla.
Well, Art,
what about all this controversy, John? We're going to cover the Hutchinson effect to sort of bring people who don't know about it up to date. But, I mean, with regard to the amount of controversy about you personally, what do you have to say?
Well, I know that it's quite controversial. I tend to, main contacts I do have seem to be from the military-industrial complex, mostly from the United States government and from NASA. However, I do get occasional emails myself. Oh, John, you're nothing but basically a crackpot, blah, 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 that kind of thing. But
yes,
everybody's entitled to their opinion.
Yes, and I'm sure in Tesla's time that he received a similar criticism, you know, a total, absolute crackpot. But we don't think of him that way these days, do we?
No, we don't.
And you have, you've discovered a number of things experimentally, right?
That's right, Art.
All right. Let's, very quickly, John, what the heck is the Hutchinson effect? What is it really?
In a nutshell?
Sure.
I'll try my best. It's using a lot of RF frequencies, electrostatic energy, high voltage types of effect, and it seems to form at a distance away from the operating apparatus to create a known, there's been papers written up on this by Andrea Sakharov and René Louis Vallée. It causes a sort of interdimensional shift.
And you're now believing it's an interdimensional shift. Please back up for me. You said RF fields, right?
That's right. Radio frequency fields.
Okay, how big are these fields? How strong?
I used actually a lot of dummy loads to load down, but 450 kilohertz at roughly, I would say, just under 500 watts, but take a dummy load and bleed a lot of that off.
All right. So you're not using all of it. Some of it goes to a dummy load, but it's way down low, 450 kilohertz. That'd be down below the lowest AM broadcast station.
Yes, basically frequency. That, Art. And then I go up to about 1750 up to 14 megahertz. Then I go and work in the 20 centimeter wavelength.
Okay, and that, so you have RF fields, and then you mentioned electrostatic as well, right?
Well, that's right. I run at about, roughly 500,000 electron volts.
A 500,000?
Mm-hmm. And that sort of bleeds off the main terminal head and collects onto round spheres. This energy is produced by a Van de Graaff generator, the thing you kind of put your hand on, your hair stands up on end.
That's right, yes, uh-huh.
I'm trying to, so the audience can understand it a bit there. And this bleeds off and fills up all these spheres full of energy, electrostatic energy.
Are these RF fields static or rotating or what?
I use RF modulation.
RF modulation, okay.
Sawtooth, sometimes CW.
Okay, thing is, John, it seems to me that what you're doing here is exactly what was described, or so very close to what was described in the Philadelphia experiment.
Well, that's been brought to my attention ever since I stumbled into this effect. Yeah, they suggested I fine-tune the equipment that I get the exact things happening, and indeed it seems that...
You are?
Yes.
All right. Now, some of the things claimed, John, are that you disintegrated or made invisible metal.
That was a discovery by the Canadian D&D, Dr. Is it all right to mention names?
It is.
Oh, okay. Dr. Lauren A. Kuhn of the STI, the Director of Scientific Technical Intelligence, analyzed the tapes and he found certain frames on the old Super 8 millimeter film had transparent metal objects where you can see through them and see behind them.
Which was exactly what the Navy allegedly was trying to do at the Philadelphia Naval Yards. They were trying, and for good reason, of course, our shipping was being sunk on a regular basis, so we had an extreme interest in making ships invisible. And I've had people technically describe to me what actually was done with the Philadelphia experiment, and it's virtually a version of what you just explained as the Hutchinson effect. Now, how did you stumble into this, John? What were you working on that suddenly turned into something else?
Well, Art, I've always had a fantastic interest in naval electronics and Tesla machinery. Basically, what I love to do is study the works of the old-timers and all the research they did. So I got inspired, and I had a lot of time on my hands during the 1970s to work on replicating a lot of the Tesla's machines and also some of the older radio fellows like Hertz and them guys, putting together this huge conglomeration of high-voltage equipment. So what I would do, basically, I'd turn out all the lights so I could actually watch all the corona effects and sparks coming from the different machines.
But what were you trying to achieve, or what did you think you would achieve? I mean, you're fooling around with a lot of RF and certainly a great deal of electrostatic charge. What did you think was going to happen? What were you trying to do?
Well, to be honest, Art, I was just having a lot of fun. And I'm not kidding, and the effects started to happen. And I honestly didn't think anything of them.
What was the first anomalous effect that you noted, John?
It was a large chunk of Bakelite, about an inch thick, roughly 8 by 6, which flipped over and hit a counter, made a large bang, and I turned on all the lights and thought, well, that's kind of interesting. Then later on, when the lights were on and the equipment running, I saw a piece of the metal flying across the room. I honestly didn't think anything, I didn't think it was important. I thought, well, maybe it's high tension electrostatics of some type. But then word leaked out, and people started to come around taking photographs.
So there are many photographs and quite a bit of old footage, I guess, of these things that you claim are true. Disappearing metal, disintegration, levitation, things floating in the air, that kind of thing?
Basically, tons of that stuff. And the folks would come around and they would try to explain to me that this is important, John. You shouldn't throw out the metal samples in the garbage, as Alex Pizarro, went out into the garbage can and pulled out these metal samples. I said, I can't use them on my lathe. But, John, this is very important what you're doing. So I said, okay, I mean, gee, you know, I'm not a scientist. I feel, you know, never made the grade 10. But nevertheless, groups started to come around, and in those days they used 8-millimeter film.
I'm certainly well aware that, you know, all of this went on, and people did come and look at it and study it. David, I'm not sure why you're here tonight with John. I guess it's kind of support. My guess would be you've investigated what John has done. Have you looked into it carefully?
Yeah, I've met John and been to his lab, and where we connected is when I started, you know, analyzing the NASA UFO videos and a lot of, you know, UFO video, and noticed that this probably the secret to their propulsion systems is that you could clearly see these waves of what appear to be electromagnetic energy strobing around the craft.
Right.
And because, for example, with infrared cameras in space, the background of space is very cold, and when an electromagnetic wave moves or strobes through the energy in space, the subatomic, you know, particles in space, you get friction and you get a heat signature. So you can actually see the waves, and because of my background in working for a nuclear physicist, I could translate those waves, and they told me what they were doing. And then when I found John Hutchison was doing the same thing with steel and causing it to levitate, it was like, eureka, oh my God, that's the connection.
So you believe that the technology or something close to the technology of the what's called the Hutchison effect is what's used to drive some of these craft that we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, how we already know that, you know, Einstein's law tells us, and it's been tested, that matter or mass in its current state cannot attain the speed of light because of the increased mass law. The faster you go,
that's right,
inertia pushes on you, you get heavier and heavier and heavier, and pretty soon you're so heavy that the amount of energy required to go a millimeter faster eventually equals the entire energy of the whole universe just to move at 99.99% the speed of light. So matter in its current state cannot attain the speed of light or go beyond. So that is obviously not how the ETs or these UFO craft are working. But if you transform mass and you, what I've coined the term, reduce the mass gravity effect by wave transformation and turn steel into, essentially, it resembles light or photonic energy, you're reducing the mass gravity effect down to zero. And once it's near zero, you can do the speed of light on tiny amounts of energy.
Well, you could almost call that a transporter, then, as easily as a spacecraft, right? It's sort of a transporter effect, isn't it? Breaking down matter or changing matter into some different form that can then travel faster than light.
Yeah, exactly. And I have spent great deals of time looking at quantum physics models from the atom and smaller and studying every physics paper I can get my hand on to find out exactly how that can happen. And I've been lecturing around the country. Last summer in Denver, I lectured, you know, at the MUFON conference. And lo and behold, at these conferences, you got NASA engineers, U.S. Army physicists, all taking down notes, and I meet these guys. And they approached me after, and they said, you know, will you write us a full, detailed physics paper on your theory and how these craft are reducing their mass gravity effect? And I wrote that paper, and I actually sent John Hutchison a copy. And he, after he read it, he said, well, we got to go on the show together with Art Bell because there's a connection here.
And so that's how all of this transpired. Now, you just happened to send a copy of this theory to John. Yes, John?
Well, yes, no, right. He did.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a good paper. It's a well-written presentation.
All right. John, in your opinion, does his theory conform, do you believe, to what it is you've observed in the effect?
Yes, it really closely follows it. I found it actually a very interesting paper, and I was reflecting when I was reading it, I was reflecting the aerospace firm's ideas of putting around toroidal shape around the lab. They had ideas that they could focus the energy, and like, I'm very visual when it comes to this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And while reading the documentation, I was reflecting back. I always seem to do that at different times in history, where McDonnell Douglas Aerospace had ideas of getting major funding and putting the lab into an environment with a large toroid around it.
With a large toroid, doing what? What do you think?
Well,
that
the main
do?
Thing with the lab there, Art, is that I can turn everything on. The effects seem to happen up to 300 feet away.
All right, let's back up a little bit. Remember I mentioned controversy at the beginning of the program. Part of the controversy is that seemingly, or many times, this effect can't be, or seemingly cannot be reproduced on simple demand each and every time. Science loves things that can be repeated and demonstrated and proven. And occasionally, or sometimes, the Hutchinson effect simply does not occur, right?
It's not something you can switch on. It usually takes roughly about an hour, half hour, for it to warm up.
Yes, but all of this taken into account, John, there are some times when the attempted repeat experiment, even by you, mm-hmm. has not worked, right?
Yes, basically, yes. But
why?
Well, I think it's basically the crudeness of the equipment. It seems I'm always steering all the different controls and that to lock on to the effects. And once that happens, I can average towards the late 80s, roughly about 5 major effects per hour, which is pretty good.
It's
and then
really
I would,
good.
If I leave the lab, then the other team would take over, and they managed to levitate objects also. So at that time, we were doing pretty good.
All right. David, have you seen enough of the hardcore evidence, the videos, the 8mm stuff, whatever it is that John has?
Yeah, I've seen...
To believe that this is irrefutably a fact.
Oh, yeah, I've seen enough of the evidence for that, and even better, every single person I've dealt with at NASA, and I'll name a few names here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mark Millis, who is the head of NASA's Breakthrough Propulsion Physics Lab, I've been on the phone with him.
Yes.
He's a young physicist, and they look at really exotic ideas over there. And he said, oh, they know all about the Hutchinson effect, and they have tried to duplicate it. And they have had some problems. So I said to Mark,
that's my point.
Why don't you hire John Hutchinson as a consultant to do it if you're having problems? And second, the paper that I've written, I believe, very explicitly details precisely why it works sometimes and why it doesn't others. And that has to do with getting into precise wave science and better, more accurate wave-producing machines, as John just mentioned. Another person at NASA who approached me is Alan Holt, who's the head of a huge propulsion division at the Johnson Space Center, and he attends some of the conferences, and he's even lecturing now in UFO conferences, and all of these guys know the problems with rocket engines and ion propulsion drives and wormholes are all too expensive in energy. They're all interested in reducing inertial mass increases as you go faster and also reducing the mass gravity effect, because they believe that is theoretically possible. And they all talk about John Hutchinson. So all of these guys, I have confirmed, absolutely know about him, including even at the X conference I just spoke at in Washington, D.C., I'm sitting in the front row, you know, watching Jaime Mison's presentation from Mexico, which was really astounding.
Yes.
And sitting next to me is an elderly gentleman. He's taking notes. He's very serious. And I'm talking to him all in the physics language about wave-transforming mass. And he's chuckling to himself, and I said, so what do you do? He said, I work for the U.S. Army. I'm a physicist. And I said, what are you doing at a UFO conference? And these guys are there. They're sitting in the aisles, and they go back to work, and they all end up finding out, consequently, about the Hutchinson effect.
Once again, John Hutchinson and David Cerita. So does that answer our friend in Chicago's question? I mean, that I've got it right, don't I, David?
Absolutely. I mean, I believe, I've seen the waves themselves on the NASA UFOs, the UFOs over Venice Beach, California, even in Nguyen Gatay's new film on the Phoenix lights, one of the young boys who was an eyewitness saw in the triangle formation, which was estimated at a mile wide, 5,000 some odd feet, they saw waves, and through the waves you could see this translucent mass, the same mm-hmm. translucent mass that Hutchinson is talking about in the Hutchinson effect. And what happens when you reduce the mass gravity effect by wave transforming mass, it eventually becomes translucent, then it turns to light, and then it disappears in these different spectrum of the electromagnetic spectrum that we do not see. And that is why there are so many accounts today, for example, of these digital home digital cameras where people are taking photos on their vacations, and they download the photos, and there's UFOs in them they couldn't see.
Right.
So Also, now what's about to get really hot with the Hutchison effect is that we've now got a program in place. I'm working with Jason Martell, and he's talking to Roger Lear to test the Roswell UFO metal samples and submit them to the Hutchison effect wave transformation process to see how they respond. Because it's possible this very unique compound, if these really are the true metal samples from the Roswell craft, I predict that they will wave transform more efficiently than a lot of the compounds we're using, you know, in the Hutchison effect today.
You're aware I'm in possession of some samples.
Yes, I am. And I think I remember this being talked about many times in Roger Lear and you know if these really are the samples and they some of them sound like they are, some of the properties about the way they're almost liquid at times. If you expose them to different waves in the Hutchison effect, who knows? Maybe this is the ultimate combination, a type of compound. I hear there's a lot of silicone or silica in the mixture.
Bismuth, magnesium, very unusual, strange, impossible to duplicate combinations, extremely thin layers, all mm-hmm. tested, all really weird. And some of the testing they did involved large amounts of electrostatic charge, very large amounts, and it really, really acted weirdly. We had video up showing how weirdly it reacted. It would jump around in the weirdest ways.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. It was wow, actually.
Yeah.
And so we have some of this, and I imagine there are other samples. Are you in a position, John, to actually perform these experiments or simply help others or what?
Well, I would love to help others. It's just that I was doing some levitation experiments for Discovery Channel networks.
Yes.
And it caused a bit of a problem for the local tenants in the area.
Like what happened?
Well, there's stuff moving around, doors moving around, people's ornaments getting squished.
Now,
the mayor of New Westminster actually came here about a month ago with a councilman.
This is very interesting. You were doing this for Discovery.
Discovery and Fox TV.
Were they financing some of this experimentation? Did they put up front money to get the equipment, get it going, or what?
No. Normally they will come here, especially in the early, 2000, 2001, and 2003 was my last demonstration, which was a very tough one, but the exterior effects were more dramatic than actually happened here. But they don't. It's basically, I'm always contacted by Discovery Channel, Fox, to do a show. It could be in relation to the Bermuda Triangle. The last major adventure I had was building a recreation of the Ark of the Covenant, which has not aired yet on TLC.
I recall, John, that you were intent on doing that the last time we spoke. So you're telling me you have brought that experiment to fruition?
Yes, I have. And it does work. And there's entities, believe it or not.
Whoa,
slow up. I'm slowing up.
You've created the Ark of the Covenant, or recreated the Ark of the Covenant, I guess would be more accurate. What have you done? What have you done?
What have I done, Art? I've had a small version of it and a large version. And we tested a large version at P&J Metals in Richmond, B.C. here, and that thing went off ballistics.
What?
Massive sparks and ionization effects and entities flying around in the room.
Whoa. Entities flying around in the room.
That's right. That's what Rudy was saying. I think my camera's not working properly, he said. So he double-checked the film when he was filming. Like, this is like 6 months of work we did.
Yes?
For Blue Book Films, who's a contractor for Discovery Channel Networks. So the main thing was major lightning and flames and white lights and strange little entities. And I had...
Did they capture this on film?
It's all on film.
It's all on film. Now, this is remarkable.
Hundreds of hours of film art, and it hasn't aired yet on TLC. I don't know why. It's on the Blue Book website, and they had a little show reel of it, and the show reel now is gone. The only thing that's left, I believe, is on the Blue Book site is credits, and they give the Ark of the Covenant revealed.
Good Lord, John. David, are you aware of all this?
Well, no, actually. I didn't know that this was something new that John was doing. But he did tell me something, and I remember looking at actual photos. In the energy fields, he could see entities actually appearing inside of the fields. that were almost angelic looking from what I remember when I saw them. And possibly, I mean, that is a way to, you know, when you think of Star Wars and these three-dimensional images of Princess Leia appearing out of R2-D2.
Right.
You know, it was almost like that. I mean, it looked like you just see this field and this three-dimensional, you know, image just floating inside of the field.
John.
Is that correct, John?
John.
Yeah, that's right.
John, I need to understand how one goes about, in effect, back engineering the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, how did you know enough about the original makeup of the Ark of the Covenant to attempt to duplicate it?
Well, I have, Art, a lot of teachers, and some of them are like Ben Franklin and many other, like history. I read books. If I'm not sure of anything, I'll read books or consult.
All right, John, where'd you get the plans for the Ark of the Covenant?
Well,
Which book had that? The Bible?
The Bible. I went by the Bible and other books.
Is the Bible specific enough to begin to back-engineer a technology?
No, not really. I had to go into other areas of research and speculation and some other scientific experiments that were done. I'm always fed information from other sources all the time.
Yes.
And there was an experiment done 30 years ago in a university somewhere back east where they did this, and this thing caused major havoc, and they dismantled it. So I went on the premise that, okay, this thing has to be powered by maybe electrostatics. We tried all the other ways with even some of my crystal material as a cement. We tried grapefruit, and then we tried the voltaic piles. That was quite a weighty voltaic pile, getting up to 100 volts. And then I thought, no, maybe something simple like electrostatics. So I supplied perhaps the conditions you'd find in Egypt, dry winds,
yes,
and that, and especially the tabernacle, which is cloth, which would collect a lot of ions in that.
So you duplicated the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you produced this high electrostatic charge.
That's right.
And swearing on the Bible, okay, you're telling me...
Yes, sir.
You produced effects that included entities that they caught and documented on camera.
Right on camera.
And David Sirita, you're standing behind this?
Yeah, I've seen some of the photographs in the field, and they do look like I said, almost like angelic-type forms. And, you know, I've personally seen this stuff with my own eyes. I've seen three-dimensional beings right in front of me, and through, you know, 25 years of practicing meditation, something's got to change in your ability to, it's like a, you know, like a radio. In Einstein's four dimensions, you have up and down, you know, width and then depth and then time, and the observer is also a part of that dimension. You could almost call the observer the fifth dimension. Now, if you can, every one of those points in Einstein's four dimensions are wave-particle relationships, and they all have frequency, including the observer. So if you change the frequency of the observer, then what you can observe, the quantity of dimensions that you can observe increases, just like moving up and down the FM dial. So in my experiences, I've seen these things three-dimensionally right in front of me. You know, humans, even my aunt when she died, I saw her right in front of me as clear as day. And what I saw inside of the field from the photos of the Hutchison effect reminds me so much of that.
All right, you too. Frequently on this program, beginning when I was doing it full-time, mm-hmm, we started hearing all these stories of so-called shadow people. You know, beings or entities, nobody's quite sure, seen kind of in flickering vision. There's a theory that in these modern times, people are staring at monitors for hours and hours and hours, computers. I'm guilty of that myself. I do it. And after spending hours staring at a computer monitor with a frame rate of, 60 refreshing per second or whatever, it begins to change the human brain a little bit in terms of vibrationally. It changes the human brain a little bit and enables people to see more of whatever it is we're seeing when we see these so-called entities or whatever they are sort of at the corner of vision. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to anybody?
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at the gap. Buddha always talked about the gap between the in and the out breath when you meditate. And then you also look at the gap between the peaks and the waves. And as your brain starts to change frequency, information,
yes,
in the in-between points of waves starts to peer through. And that is where these other dimensions are. And I think if you expose your brain, which is a wave machine, to a computer or any electric current long enough, it's going to start to manipulate the wave state of the brain, and maybe those gaps start to get wider and wider and more of that information starts to come through. When you see one of these things yourself, I mean, even thinking of shadow beings as black, mysterious figures, again, these things can appear black, but it literally could be a much higher frequency than we're used to seeing, so you just get a void, but you do get a shape. You do get an actual form. And if you're able to see high enough in frequency, that form will start to have detail. And what's strange about this apparatus that John has set up is it works the same way. It's a wave field, and that field is possible. It's acting as a, you know, almost like a medium between those higher dimensional energies and what we see, and it allows it to reflect inside of that field. And that's a communication device. And maybe the Ark of the Covenant was such a thing. It was a communication device to communicate with God. I mean,
Or
demigod or God or whatever we want to call it.
Yeah, I wonder about the advisability of opening doors like that. I mean, when you endeavor to reinvent the Ark of the Covenant, it seems to me you're inviting the possibility of, well, God knows what.
God knows what. Sometimes, well, that's why I like to study a friend of mine, Colonel Alexander's work on the mental battlefield in psychotronics.
Yes, I know Colonel Alexander well, and I know that he has attempted to observe some of what you've done, right?
That's right, and he's also appeared on several TLC TV specials with me.
All right. No offense, John or Dana, but if they had video of John creating an effect which produced recordable videotaped entities in a field, that would be so hot.
Oh, yeah.
It would be so hot.
It is art. That's so hot that it
Then how can it not run as a special?
It should. I feel it should run 2 hours.
That's actually a great idea.
1 hour.
I mean, I'm in the business of making films now. My newest film, Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs, just appeared at Cannes Film Festival, and I've got, you know, major studio releasing it in Hollywood. And, you know, I'm just going to make more and more of these films. And that's
great, David, but how could this, I mean, this would be so hot that it doesn't take you to think of, gee, what a great idea, why don't I do that? They should be clamoring to do that.
You think they would if they were so open-minded, but look at the Peter Jennings special. I mean, there's real UFO footage out there that I offered the producers of Peter Jennings, and they wanted to do simulations. They didn't want to show the real thing because that would scare people too much.
Oh, you really believe that?
I believe that. I think a simulation is more safe. It's like a buffer zone. You know, you're hearing, you know, eyewitness accounts and testimony and hearsay. But if you're looking at real videotape, you know, of the giant triangles, the Phoenix lights, the UFOs that Jeff Willis is getting in Phoenix.
Yes.
Pat Uskert stuff, the Mark Olson stuff up in Sonora. I mean, I've met all these guys. This is good footage. And I think that, and I offered it to the producers of Peter Jennings, and they didn't want to run it. But
that's rather sad.
A story like this, beings in a field, I mean, and angelic-like beings, and John has had, you know, some of his own personal experiences, I believe, just from, like you said, staring in front of the computer all day. He's working around these fields all the time. And aside from, you know, the Hutchison effect, there's been some incredible communication experiences he's had as well.
Well, it's interesting, David. Going back some years, when I was my ex, who made a film that appeared on Entertainment Tonight called Miracle of the Unknown, she went out and interviewed such people like Tom Bearden, Burkhard Heim, reconfirming all the UFO technology. And it hasn't aired yet in the U.S. or Canada, but has aired many times overseas. I think you actually seen that one time.
I can understand that ABC could have gone farther. They were taking a first step.
It was a good first step.
You've got to really remember that. I mean, they were trying to, seriously, for the first time, God bless their souls for doing it, do something on ufology, and they certainly did. Now, I'm not sure that you could go as far as you're suggesting right now without, as you pointed out, scaring the hell out of people. The greater, you know, civilized world out there may not be quite ready for this.
Yeah, I mean, everyone in the UFO world is upset about Peter Jennings. Myself, even though I was only on for 15 seconds, they interviewed me for 80 minutes, and they asked the best questions I've ever heard. I mean, by the way, his producers and the directors were really good at probing your mind and getting the deep stuff out of you. So they have archives of everybody's interviews. But even though we're all upset, the general public got, you know, UFO 101. They got their first step, and maybe step two will go much deeper.
Exactly. And now it's understandable that ufology would be upset because
sure.
They know so much more, and they expected it to be the holy grail of the current cutting edge. Well, it wasn't that, but I don't think you could really do that immediately. You've got to bring people up to these things.
You've got to bring them up. And for the people who want to know the deep stuff, you come to the conferences, and it's like going to university for 3 days, and you'll come out of there with, you know, your head in the clouds.
Yeah, or you listen to programs like this.
Listen to programs like this. I mean, radio is still far better than television, in my opinion, to tell the truth, because you can spend the time. And television time is too expensive, and look at news today. It's like fast food, unless you watch McNeil Air NewsHour. I listen to the radio, and I go on the Internet, because the radio, your show and George Norrie and, you know, some of the alternative news sites, that's where you get the details. And you find out stories like you were talking tonight about. I didn't know there were, unprecedented tornadoes up in Canada near the Rockies and all up and down the Midwest, because they're not reporting that stuff.
Well, it's there to be seen. It's simply not reported. But there are incredible numbers of large storms, supercells, tornadoes, a gigantic hail that's just absolutely causing havoc. All right, Sean in Newark, Delaware says, "Hey, Art, news update. I just heard about the severe weather in the Midwest. They're reporting the tornadoes and very severe thunderstorms." That's Ham in Delaware. Sean, thank you, Sean. Yes, I know. It's to those who are observing it, watching it, it's an incredible thing that's going on right now. Now, just before we move on to the weaponization of space with John and David, I do want to ask a couple of things. John, there's somebody who is looking at your website and would like to understand, I guess it kind of goes with what we're talking about, but this portal effect.
The portal effect.
Yes.
It's basically what David was talking about. It was captured on Super 8 millimeter film about 1980. And what happened was, when I was experimenting, the whole room turned into like a portal, and you could see these little entities running around inside of it.
Yeah, there we are.
Can I just sort of reverse my engines for a second, because there's something rather important I should maybe mention before.
Indeed.
Go full forward. Is that my work was presented at MIT May 21 by Ken Shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
It's in regards to charge cluster technologies. And what Ken does is do the metal samples on a microscopic level, but he can actually freeze in time and space radioactive waste. So we feel that we have a commonality in getting rid of the nuclear problem.
He can freeze nuclear waste in time. What do you mean by that?
Well, he has a way of discharging in a chamber some radioactive materials with high voltage, and it seems to what appears is a similarity on a microscopic level to the SEMs and X-ray diffraction of my metal samples.
But basically what it's doing is rendering the dangerous radioactive material harmless?
Yes. I was with him also in 1997 before. It was actually sponsored by the Star Trek people and Larry King. And we had these meetings where we were talking about Ken Shoulder's charge cluster technologies, and how it could be so important in getting it for the use in elimination of nuclear radiation.
Yes, we living near Yucca Mountain would be very thankful. Is this going to be presented to people who count?
Yes, of course.
Well, is it an alternative to storing the mass we have of this dangerous stuff in Yucca Mountain?
I do believe so. I really believe in Ken Shoulder's work. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I met Ken. Met his teams and that, and we met politicians who are very interested in this.
All right. Are you up on this, David?
Yeah, I've worked a lot in this field in, you know, nuclear fusion and the nuclear sciences, and that Hal Fox at Cold Fusion Associates, you know, part of the Cold Fusion work, they were able to stabilize nuclear waste by transmutating it into these more stable states where it doesn't emit, you know, the various forms of radiation. And also now there are these new fuel cells in England, a company that I've worked with, can take nuclear waste and just like hydrogen fuel cells, it actually produces electricity, and as it produces electricity, it becomes more and more stable. But rather than using nuclear reactions to boil, you know, produce heat and boil water, this just relies on the photoelectric effect, you know, which is how Einstein won the Nobel Prize, which is the transference of, you know, radiation or electromagnetic energy into electricity. And there's many methods out there done. Now, U.S. Ecology is the company, one of the largest contractors for handling nuclear waste. When I approached them about Hal Fox's discovery, which is very similar to Hutchison's.
David, let me just slow you down one second and ask you, that transformation you're talking about, if it doesn't occur through boiling water and that kind of a heat transfer with a reaction, I'm not understanding how it does work.
Well, the way it works is, like, do you understand the photoelectric effect, which is how Einstein won the Nobel Prize in the beginning, is the transference of electromagnetism either through light or through radio waves or through even gamma emissions or beta emissions, which is just pure electron emissions. What happens with unstable material is it's emitting radioactive waves. Now, those waves can be converted directly to electricity. It's very similar to how solar panels pick up photon energy and convert it to electricity. And there are ways of
you're saying the frequency of the emission from this material can be captured the way the sun is captured by a cell and converted to electricity.
Yeah, absolutely. There are certain nuclear reactions. For one, the last show we did, I talked about helium-3. Helium-3 doesn't even use heat. It converts everything directly. It produces charged protons. When you fuse helium-3, you produce a huge amount of energy. It's 9 times more efficient than uranium per fuel weight, and there's no radioactivity, and it doesn't boil water like uranium does. You slow fission uranium to produce the enormous heat. You boil water. Whenever you boil water, you lose 60% of your initial energy, and then that's how nuclear power works. And then
yes,
you have all this radioactive waste to deal with. Well, the waste, there's different types of waste. There's high-grade waste is the pellets, you know, the uranium pellets. And that stuff is still producing energy, and it's still radioactive highly when they, you know, dispose of it. Now, all those radioactive emissions can be either transferred. You can use the photoelectric effect to get the energy out of it. And there's also other methods that people in the fuel cell business are finding that they can extract energy directly out of it.
How much energy are we talking about?
Well, certainly from what I know, this particular company that's in England, I have introduced them to Air Products. Air Products is the largest hydrogen manufacturing company in America. And Air Products is very interested in this particular fuel cell because they can take ordinary garbage, which, you know, gives off methane, and they can produce
energy.
All
right, I want to understand the scale, David.
Yeah.
How much electricity?
It depends how radioactive the material is and how much energy, how many emissions the material is giving off, because you have high-level radioactive waste, you have low-level waste.
In other words, what would be a typical practical application? Could you put together something that would equal a large electrical plant today, a nuclear plant? What are we talking about?
No, I think these fuel cells are more like things that could maybe run appliances in your home, you know, your computer. I mean, there's many times, and this is kind of funny, but I look at my iPod, and I can't believe how much power this thing puts out, and I think there's got to be nuclear waste in this thing. I mean, how does it, you know, how do you recharge an iPod and it pumps out sound like that? It just doesn't make sense. And I think those are the kind of places you can make these small fuel cells, you know, for a single lamp, a computer, you know, things like that. But companies aren't interested in the weight, because
I
it doesn't
understand.
Have that much energy.
I understand. However, wouldn't such a device in a consumer's hands with nuclear waste driving it be kind of dangerous?
It would, and that's, I think for that particular transmutation of nuclear waste issue into energy, they're probably going to do it in cells, and then the power leaves the station. I mean, right now, most of our nuclear waste in this country is stored on-site at the nuclear power plants because they have not approved Yucca Mountain.
That's right.
And they don't. Nobody wants the stuff anywhere, so it ends up staying on-site, and the workers, of course, get, you know, affected by radioactivity, and then we use it in, you know, of course, in the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan. We're tipping, you know, we're sending all of our bullets and munitions loaded with, nuclear waste tip bullets, and we're trying to get rid of this stuff everywhere. But it's lower level emissions of radioactivity that are of less interest to the big power companies, but there's still a lot of energy you can extract, and yeah, it would have to be in a safe place. So nuclear waste dump sites would be a place that you could extract energy directly, and also there are many other forms of waste. I mean, hospitals produce huge amounts of nuclear waste. They're the second largest producer in the country.
And with correct transmutation, could be used for power. All right.
Yeah.
I want to change subjects here and talk about the weaponization of space. The U.S. has taken an interesting position. Clearly, I quoted an Air Force general, I think, last week, who said we have a lot of very important satellites that we could not afford to lose in a war or a conflict. And many other nations are beginning to build spacecraft capable of destroying our satellites. Therefore, we have to protect them. This is a big fight going on in Washington, indeed the world right now. Mm-hmm. Are we going to put weapons in space, or perhaps, even as I suspect, do we already have them?
Well, I mean, Reagan started this with Star Wars, and it's interesting that Reagan was someone who had a personal experience, you know, with seeing a UFO, and he made the very famous statement at the United Nations, you know, hypothetically saying, what if we were suddenly facing an alien threat from outside this world?
Yes.
And that's the president who brought us Star Wars, and now we're talking about, you know, doing it again and going beyond because we're making breakthroughs with technology. So I wonder, is it really the satellites? Is it really, and that's a good argument. I mean, you can definitely believe that because if someone starts taking out our satellites and our telecommunication systems go down, we're easier to take out. But also the incredible amount of UFO appearances all over the planet just keeps growing and growing and growing. And I got to wonder if what Reagan said, you know, and imagine if he said that at the United Nations, what did he say behind closed doors? And, you know, is that why we're going, you know, forward in weaponizing space?
And we are going forward, is that correct?
And apparently, yes. And apparently when Reagan was, you know, met the same resistance that we're meeting from China and Russia today. You know, they're threatening us if we go ahead with this because it starts the Cold War again. And yet, behind closed doors, Reagan was able to defuse that because he said, this isn't really about, we're worried about you guys. It's about the extraterrestrial threat. And once they all saw that, they sighed and realized there was a great relief that if the Americans aren't doing this to actually, you know,
you believe they bought that?
Well, considering the Chinese and the Russians are taking the UFO phenomenon seriously in their universities and are studying
it. Okay, let's take it a step further. David, do you believe that President Reagan took them some kind of proof that this was so, that there was a common threat?
Well, it's funny when we all say proof. I mean, we have the Roswell samples. We have eyewitnesses. We have guys like Gordon Cooper who testified to seeing UFOs, and a lot of people don't even consider that proof. We have videotape, which many people think can be faked. But when you see one of these things yourself, like you have, Art, you know, over the highway, the triangle that came down, and I saw the one in Berkeley in 1967, and Reagan saw one himself. When you see one, all the videotapes in the world suddenly look real to you.
Yes, but David, if I was the President of the United States and I was going to try to convince at that time Russia and now China that, don't worry, these weapons that we're putting up there, they're not because of you, they're because of this other thing, this threat from outer space. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't expect to be able to sell that to them, David, unless I had more than just words.
Yeah, I think one thing, if it was the President of the United States saying, look, I have seen one of these things myself, that would not necessarily suffice, but it would raise some eyebrows. But, you know...
David, I'd have to walk in with some kind
of... Yeah, and this is... I mean, I'm going to give you a case example here. Since, you know, my first film came out, Exploring the Invisible and the Ultraviolet and NASA Looking the Invisible, I got a call from a military guy who works in Space Command, which is a division of our military that uses satellites and looks at the Earth and the near space environment and all the spectrum of light, visible and invisible. And he cited incidences to me on the phone where a general marched in because they had an incident where on ultraviolet they could see these balls of light coming in towards the Earth, and then they did a U-turn and went out into space.
Mm-hmm.
And the general marched in, confiscated all the videotapes, and these guys all laughed because they said, we see these things all the time. Now, if they have that kind of evidence from military, you know, surveying satellite systems around our planet,
yes,
I think they could share that with the Chinese and the Russians and say, look, you know, there is something going on. We are being visited, and we need to protect the space environment of the planet, and so we at least stand a chance in case.
All right, David, let's see what you know about this. I think most in the audience agree that these craft, or whatever the hell they are here.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we intervene? I mean, occasionally, individually, for example, I had a call, a week ago, a guy said that a UFO followed his truck, and he finally got so angry that this good old boy hopped out of the truck and took several shots at this UFO with a .357 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he shot at the UFO. That's an individual occurrence, I think, ill-advised. Are we nationally doing this? I mean, you know, it's ridiculous that our government say UFOs are not a national security threat.
Well, see, I think...
It's just crazy, David, because if they're flying in our airspace and we don't control them, they're a threat.
They may even be from another country and black ops programs from Russia or China or, God forbid, the Middle East. And that is a point that I brought up in the Venice UFO case. I phoned the FAA in the Los Angeles airport and said, you know, this thing is not a balloon. We've done balloon tests. Did you guys see this thing on radar? And the number one question is, why weren't you up there? This is post 9/11.
Why are we not intervening? We've never watched the skies this carefully, as you point out, since 9/11. So what's up?
Yeah, and why aren't your jets up there chasing these things around? If we can see them, and people are videotaping them over Phoenix all the time, where are you guys?
Yes, and?
And that concerns me, because what if they're not from another planet? What if they are from another country, and they're probes, or they are advanced aircraft, and we're not up there?
So there can either be one of two answers. One, they're there. They know they're there. They know they can't do anything about it. Or two, they're our own.
Yeah, and that's when you start to think, I don't believe we're that stupid. If something is in our airspace, it's either invisible to radar, which when their mass gravity effect is very low and translucent, microwave photons, which is what radar is, they just pass right through them like butter.
Well, let's ask John. John, is it possible that your effect has been not only discovered, but perhaps perfected by the military, and that we do have craft that can virtually change the makeup of their mass and virtually disappear to the human eye or go wherever they go when the effect that you stumbled on is applied?
I tend to believe, Art, that they have replicated it. I get signals and messages from the early 90s about that basically we let them too close. I mean, this stuff was presented in the Pentagon in 1980, and they came and investigated it. Then the Canadian government got involved also to investigate it. But when I'm trying to retrieve the video stock, especially from the Canadian government, those people don't exist, although I have all their letters and all their names. And it's interesting to note that...
What do you mean they don't exist?
You cannot contact them. They deny they were ever here. And I'm trying to go through the Freedom of Information Act to the Canadian government.
These would be people who observed your experiments.
Yeah.
Suddenly, well, no, we weren't.
Vanished.
Weren't at John's place. We didn't see anything.
That's right. And they forget, of course, that I have a lot of mail correspondence from these folks, and that I know their names. We corresponded on a very heavy level. I have all this documentation. Some of it's on my website.
That's also, absolutely.
You know, Art, it's interesting that you're talking about this because in the last 10 months, there's been a really heavy traffic and phone calls to me and emails and letters to me from NASA, from the Pentagon, from SAIC, I'm not sure what that stands for, and many
Science Applications International Corporation.
And I have all this stuff printed out. It comes to almost 2 inches of material. And it seems to go in waves. And I get, you know, they say, well, can you send us videos? So I'll send videos to the Air Force Division of the Pentagon. I don't want to mention names in case I get hit on the head.
Yeah, I don't want you hit on the head. All right, once again, John Hutchison and David Sirita. David, you know, that's one thing that goes to John's credibility. He does such wild, out-on-the-edge stuff, and then claims these contacts with, you know, NASA. I mean, DOD, big, important people, space-related agencies, that kind of thing. Can you verify these contacts?
Well, firstly, one of the things I did when I went up to film and interview John is he showed me all of the letters that he got from these different agencies, and I looked them over, and they're definitely authentic. I mean, when I worked for Department of Defense in bomb detection, I got a lot of letters from different divisions of the military, and you know, there's definitely the letters are very similar. I mean, the letterhead, the stationery, the paper, you know, it definitely has the seal of the United States embedded in the fabric of the paper. So this isn't made up. These aren't made up letters. And secondly, from myself having conversations with people I know at NASA and. Like Mark Millis is not someone I know well at NASA. I've had a conversation with him, and he definitely said they have tried to duplicate the Hutchison effect on their own. And what's his Alan Holt, who is one of the heads of the whole propulsion divisions at the Johnson Space Center, is now lecturing on UFOs this summer for the first time at MUFON in Denver, Colorado this summer. So. He went from just being an observer, Alan Holt, and studying crop circles and not letting too many people in the agency know what he was up to now actually getting involved because he's becoming more and more convinced. And then third, when you look at, you know, some of these different people who are attending these conferences, U.S. Army physicists that I've met with, I am, with God as my witness, I'm telling you the truth. I've met these people. When evidence, the case for NASA UFOs first came out, one of our first buyers was Lockheed Martin, the Aerospace Corporation, and that is another company John has had look into the Hutchison effect. Now, the only thing that's disturbing to me about all of it is I get the same answer every time. You know, Alan Holt says that he's really interested in my theory and the way I can explain on a quantum level how to reduce the mass gravity effect of a single atom and how that relates to the Hutchison effect. But he said, be patient, because he said under this administration, the Bush administration, there's very little money for exotic propulsion concept research and actual experimentation.
Well, they appear interested enough. I mean, if they're sending these guys to UFO conferences, they're very interested.
They're very interested. Now, the other thing is, what if there's no funding coming to NASA for exotic propulsion research, but at Lockheed and, you know, some of the SAIC is Science Applications International Corporation. They're one of the top four defense contractors, and allegedly people have tracked airplanes going to Area 51 out of their airport in San Diego where their headquarters are. And maybe on a black level they are spending money on this stuff, but why not? And I asked, Alan Holt at NASA and John Schussler, who is head of International Director of MUFON, was also a contractor for NASA, working with Boeing and, you know, Gemini days. And the last thing he did at NASA in 1998, he built the Advanced Space Propulsion Lab for Franklin Chang Diaz, the Costa Rican-American physicist who was on mission number STS-75, the very famous, you know, incident where I attest that there are UFOs appearing in the ultraviolet. Now, all these guys are aware of this stuff. And the problem is, according to NASA and Mark Millis' program, which has a fantastic website, you know, NASA's Breakthrough Propulsion Physics Lab, but it's $50,000 a year program.
All right. Listen, The evidence for UFO propulsion apparently led to the conclusions that John's effect, the Hutchinson effect, levitating the cannonball, for example, was utilizing a similar method to produce anti-gravity. Now, after you've seen a craft like I've seen, you realize that you either saw an extraterrestrial craft or you clearly saw the U.S. government with the ability to reverse the effects of gravity or escape the effects of gravity. Or I don't know how you would exactly put it, but there's no question this thing wasn't flying. It was floating. It was defying gravity in some way.
And John, it's not using thruster engines because it's quiet.
Dead quiet. Crickets at a quarter mile quiet.
Right.
So, John, do you think they might have essentially perfected what you did and are using it now?
I feel they are, Art, because of all the emails I get from different scientists. And some of the scientists appear on TLC shows along with Nick Cook, like Boyd Bushman, Lockheed Martin.
Yes.
And he's kind of a fan of mine who's researched out my work, and he's doing his own experiments, actually. And, yes, I have to say they have to do it. I mean, if I could have done it, you know, primitive equipment, they have massive resources to do it in the national laboratories. I'm sure they're doing it.
All right, David, if they have craft that can currently defy gravity, then how are we to delineate between U.S. government experimental craft and, I don't know, extraterrestrial craft?
Well, I would go to the energy source. For example, the Betty Cash case, you have the severe radiation burns from the victims who were near the craft.
Yes.
And obviously, you know, they're using nuclear fuels like uranium and plutonium and other highly radioactive fuels for their energy source for these advanced nuclear propulsion methods. Because when you reduce the mass gravity effect of a craft, you initially need a huge energy burst, such as, you know, Bob Lazar's element 115 would produce, but only for a fraction of a second. Now, once you reduce the mass down to nothing, you don't need hardly any energy to sustain it once it's in that state. But initially, you need these bursts of energy. And today, we have not mastered the non-radioactive nuclear fuels like helium-3. We don't know how, even though helium-3 beckons us with the most profound energy source on the planet, far beyond hydrogen, far beyond uranium, because it's non-radioactive and you don't have all the radiation problems, I think the way we determine between an alien craft and one of ours is the radiation and the harmful radiation. And there are cases even in Mexico recently when Jaime Muson presented of victims who got severe radiation burns. Now, really advanced UFO crafts from other planets, obviously you can't come from another star system to Earth and be exposed to radiation, harmful radiation, for that long and survive. You wouldn't be here. You wouldn't make the trip. You'd die before you got here. So there are still a long ways to go with it. I mean, to master the non-radioactive energy sources as fuel.
So you think the radiation is the key to which it is?
Harmful radiation, yes. But, again, once you get to the point where you can reduce the mass gravity effect of a craft down to zero or near zero, I don't believe in absolute zeros, you essentially don't need energy anymore. It's not about energy, and I think that's what the ETs have discovered, is that they've been in the same position we are in today. You know, the rocket engines, increasing energy on mass, G-force problems get so difficult. Imagine even doing one-tenth the speed of light, which is 67 million miles per hour, and an incoming asteroid is going to hit you, and you got to turn right. A subtle turn, G-forces will kill you at that velocity. And there are even Bob Lazar's theory that they're using gravity generators. I mean, gravity generators are competing gravity fields that the craft envelops itself in. And even though it's a nice-looking theory on paper, when you go flying by a sun or a moon, even 1/100th the speed of light, the G-forces on turns in competing gravity fields are going to be so strong they'll destroy you. But if you're zero mass gravity effect, you can turn right and you won't feel any G-forces. And that's how UFOs move. They stop on a dime, they turn right, they suddenly accelerate. And once you're in that state, you don't need these radioactive fuels anymore. You don't need to use your fuel. So if we're looking at an extraterrestrial craft, it would exhibit those qualities. One of our own, I don't know if we're there yet. I don't know. We might be producing the giant triangles. Some of the, I mean, these triangles are being seen everywhere.
Everywhere, that's
Florida,
right.
Florida, Texas, they've been up on your site recently. I mean, there's no way those are B-2 bombers. B-2 bombers make a lot of noise, and they're using jet engines. There's just no way. These things are silent, these triangles. They're huge.
The only two possibilities are some sort of, a lighter-than-air ship, or clearly we're defying gravity. What I saw looked very, very solid, but I could have been fooled. It could have been a lighter-than-air craft. But as you point out, they're everywhere. They're over our interstates. They seem that's something that puzzles me. And maybe one of you has an answer. I mean, if you had a secret craft, you wouldn't fly the damn thing over the major interstate highways of America.
Yeah, I mean, I skydive out at Paris Valley, California, and these guys are pretty strict out there as far as UFO phenomena. And because they recognized who I am, one of them, the owners of the drop zone, came up to me and said they had a huge UFO come right over the house where a lot of the skydivers spend the night, and they went outside and this thing was dead silent and it was massive. She said it must have been a mile across. And these are non-believers. These are all military people who like to have fun skydiving on the weekend. And why? You know, why, if it's one of ours, what's it doing over a drop zone?
Exactly. John?
Yes, it's interesting to mention the power sources. Could it be zero-point energy?
Well, see, zero-point energy, to me, is when you reduce the mass gravity effect down to zero, you're actually requiring less and less energy to move about, and that's when you start tapping into the zero-point energy field itself. Now, there's a recent physics paper for those real techies out there written by Don Hodson called Dirac's Equation and the Sea of Negative Energy. It's in two parts. It's the most stunning paper. It was rejected by mainstream physics. And I always look at the papers by the big names like Dirac that are rejected, because if mainstream physics knew how to break the speed of light, how to get a spaceship to even levitate, that would mean they have the answers and I should be reading their work. But they obviously haven't figured that out. So I read this paper, and this is a top nuclear physicist. And in this paper, he talks about all matter being born out of a singularity called the Sea of Negative Energy. See, matter, I'll use a spiritual model here to explain how matter is born into duality and also the actual, you know, subatomic level, and keep it simple. You know, I'll keep it short and simple. You know, you go back to the Garden of Eden, and Adam and Eve are told not to partake of the knowledge of good and evil, for on the day you do, you'll surely die. Well, when you take in good and evil is a conflict, which is actually a duality. It's positive and negative energy. And if you imagine the angelic kingdom is in a state of singularity or oneness, there is no duality there. There is no conflict. Duality falls into a lower dimension, and in that ignorant state, it becomes physical. Now, without getting too philosophical, basically what happens is if millions of people take in the knowledge of good and evil, they each define egotistically what is good and what is evil, and they're always different. So we always end up fighting. Now, coincidentally or not, the atom is coded with the same information. A hydrogen atom has a proton, which is positively charged, and an antiproton, which spins negative. So positive, negative. And you have an electron, which spins negative, and you have an anti-electron spinning positive. So it's just like good and evil. It's duality. Now, if you can light, the only particle we know of that can bounce off of the Earth that escapes gravity, the true anti-gravity particle is a photon, is single. Now, Jesus says in the Gospels, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light. Coincidentally, when you end duality in matter, you become single. And that singular, the only particle in physics we know of that is single is light. Now, light has to move through an actual ether, an actual background of space, which itself is a wave. So it pushes against it, it meets some resistance, and it has a limit of the speed of light. But Dirac's Sea of Negative Energy, which is singly charged, light is singly charged, positive single charged. Imagine this sea of negative energy that that is singly charged. If, you know, if you're singly charged, there's no resistance. You don't encounter inertia. An entire space, uniform space pervading the entire universe, that is single, because resistance, inertia, is born when you have two waves that are opposing each other. Which
David,
is,
this
well,
is really all quantum, isn't it?
It's quantum.
Yes.
So Dirac's paper is and the sea of negative energy shows the birth of matter from this singularity. Now, if you could flip your UFO, first of all, reducing it down to zero, this is where the real zero point is, because it's a singularity zero. It's not a dual electric field like we have here. You know, the alternating current that Tesla invented is positive, negative, positive, negative.
Right.
Well, when you enter singularity, you're so far beyond the speed of light, it's ridiculous. In fact, you can't even use it, because everything is instantaneous, because there's no resistance. So you could conquer any distance. You could go from here to Andromeda.
Yeah, well, that would explain the quantum communication that otherwise is completely inexplicable.
Exactly, because it's instantaneous over any distance.
Yes.
Now, if we can tap into Dirac's sea of, and don't be misconstrued by the word negative energy. It's not negative spiritual energy. It's just, it's spinning counterclockwise. But it's singularity that I'm talking about. And a lot of physicists today are looking for something beyond the dual pairedness of the dual state of matter, and they're looking for what's called singularities. And sometimes, some people believe they're at the end of a black hole and the end of the Einstein-Rosen bridges, and Dirac is saying that there is a pathway into this sea of energy, and where it is where all matter is born from, and it returns. And that may be philosophically what even happened when you consider the resurrection of Christ. I mean, he took physical mass and he transformed it into light, and he could move around, you know. And there are examples of masters in Buddhism and other religions that have done the same thing.
So why it's not out of line then to say that it is good and it is evil. If you're a religious person, it makes that exact transition.
Well, yeah, this realm is good and evil, but Jesus is, even in the Gospel of Philip, which was rejected by the church, he says, in this world there is good and evil. It's good things are not good, and it's evil things not evil, because he's trying to show you there's something beyond it. Because good and evil is always a conflict.
Yes. The two of you think you understand why the SETI telescopes can't locate a signal.
Right.
Why?
I believe for two reasons. One, they are looking at information in light waves that are too low in frequency. Longer or lower frequency waves, as they travel through space, they collide and share information with other long-standing waves, and they get distorted. And we only have the ability right now, as you know, in radio, to look at information inside of light waves, which is what radio is, in the, you know, gigahertz or billion hertz range. We haven't even hit a trillion hertz, and we certainly haven't hit a quadrillion hertz.
So you think we're just not looking high enough?
We're not looking high enough, and that's one possibility. But here's something that's really going to blow people's minds. This, remember the book, The Secret Life of Plants, that
yes.
came out in the 70s?
Yeah, of course.
They made a documentary, and this is stunning because this documentary was never released, and I got to see it. A very famous astrophysicist who is working at major universities today, and I have his name written down, he took a telescope and surrounded it with a Faraday cage to block out interfering radiation
mm-hmm.
and pointed it at the star system of Sirius and put living mustard seeds at the end of the telescope to receive the light rays from Sirius. Now,
what? Mustard seeds?
Sprouted mustard seeds, living.
What does that have to do with receiving it?
Okay, this is interesting. So he, just like in The Secret Life of Plants, they connected electrodes to the mustard seeds and they suddenly got what appeared to be intelligent blips and signals.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
These are called biophotons, and you can search biophotons on Google, and you'll get tons of pages on this stuff. But living photons versus dead radio waves may be able to communicate in this sea of negative energy in real time.
Once again, John Hutchison and David Sarita, and I wonder if what we're talking about here is a real-world quantum effect. In other words, the seeds on the telescope. It sounds wacky on the one hand. Welcome back, you two. What kind of seeds were those again, please?
They were mustard, sprouted living mustard seeds. And, you know, that's what the book, The Secret Life of Plants, initiated, was to, you know, communicate signals.
You're right.
With plants. And even though, go back to Philip Colonel Corso for a minute. In his
book, to understand how the planets communicated to each other as quantum objects have been noted to do through time and space, through, faster than the speed of light, certainly. Unmeasurable, actually. And so this whole quantum thing has been, so many of my guests, David and John, have been talking about this new quantum world we're about to leap into. And so I'm curious, with regard to the mustard seeds, please, what was actually seen through the telescope that was not seen otherwise when looking at Sirius?
It's not the visual that was different. It was the information in the photons coming from Sirius that stimulated the plant seeds, the sprouted mustard seeds, and the transference of the how the seeds responded into through like the EEG system where you hook electrodes up to the brain and you get signals. That's what was done in The Secret Life of Plants with Clive Baxter. He was the one who started the research and proved that plants had feelings and could perceive emotions.
Okay, but what are you suggesting?
Well, the mustard seed started blipping, and it seemed like an intelligent signal. Now, the astrophysicist who did it, I'm going to have to get his name and email it to you, because there is information about him. He's gone on to do major work in astronomy, but no one followed up on that. Now, isn't it curious that Colonel Philip Corso said that the grays were half living, half machine?
That's right.
And is there a connection? Is there a reason they were half living, half machine? And also, the human aura also gives off what are called living or biophoton energies, which are now measurable in quantum physics. Is there a difference between a radio wave, which is kind of a mechanical dead wave, which travels at the speed of light, and a biophoton? Now, I propose that biophotons' frequencies are so high they eventually enter singularity. At the highest frequencies, and that singularity, there is no resistance. And that is why they can travel beyond the speed of light, and possibly the mustard seeds are communicating in real time. There is no speed of light, or even 100 times the speed of light. It's actual real time with any distance. And that the information is in the photons coming from Sirius, but radio telescopes can't detect it. They can't pull the information out of it.
I'm curious. You said that the scientist involved was able to, he thought, detect some sort of pattern. Do you know what?
Yes, some sort of pattern, and that was in the film. And this was, it's funny, they never, the book was a big success, but they never released the documentary. But there are copies of it floating around, and it's really old, you know, 70s film footage, so it doesn't look great. But when I saw that, I was like, you know, I've made connections to that particular star system many times before in my work, with the NASA UFO phenomenon. We all know that's where, you know, the Egyptian mythologies come from, the star system of Sirius and the dog star. And it's a legendary star system. It may be where our, you know, co-creators are from.
Two of you believe, John particularly, John, I wonder if you believe that your effect or something like it helped build the pyramids, perhaps the Coral Castle in Florida, the things that are so inexplicable. A human could not have done it without some kind of effect.
I have been approached with that question from various people about that.
Now me.
Now you, Art. And it's a good question. It's a very valid question because I was in Egypt and I saw the pyramids and those massive stones from Luxor, from the different areas that we went out traveling. And I would have to say something else was at play there. I cannot envision ropes in that time period that strong that could possibly lift that stuff up. I mean, even the weight of the rope would hold the people down.
Well, there is no duplicating it, John, period. They've tried. It can't be duplicated.
I saw a TV show on that.
The single man who did what he did at Coral Castle can't be duplicated. Some sort of effect was used. Does it sound like the Hutchison effect or something like it?
Yes, it does, in many ways, Art. This is Coral Castle is quite an interesting, intriguing mystery, because I like studying stuff very intently. Like, I look at every photograph and pictures and that. And I saw parts of the lab and equipment that he had down there at Coral Castle, and I could relate to it.
You understood some of what he was doing just based on the photographic evidence?
Just the photographic evidence of the remaining bits and pieces of electronic surplus, basically.
What about you, David? Have you looked into the building of the pyramids or Coral Castle and tried to understand the power?
I mean, when you're talking about being able to wave transform even stones or steel and
yes.
produce the mass gravity effect, it starts to levitate.
Exactly.
Again, photons are in a single wave state and matter is dual paired, and when the only thing we can see that actually levitates off the Earth are photons. They bounce off the Earth and go out into space. Gravity can bend the path of a photon, but it can't stop it from, you know, leaving the Earth. So if matter can you know, even become overcome the differential between positive and negative, one of those gets stronger, the effects of gravity gets less, and it starts to rise. Now, if you can do that to huge stones, that's the secret behind the highest degree masons in Egypt who were able to do this, to build the pyramids. And that would, imagine what that would do today. I mean, if we could build, I mean, I know about the Coral Castle, and this man says that he's not revealing his secret, but maybe he knows the same thing we're talking about. It's about transforming mass. In its current state,
mass.
You can't do it. But in its transformed state, imagine, I mean, we could build Lord of the Rings style temples and castles on mountaintops and you know, even these things that George Lucas is showing in the new Star Wars, cities on the top of glacier mountains. I mean, that's all in the future. That's all something we'll be able to do. And masonry is one of the areas we benefit, which is, you know, building with stone. I believe that's absolutely how they did it.
All right, David and John both. Bob Lazar, I know Bob Lazar quite well. He's now out of town, so to speak, sort of settled down and quiet, not wanting to talk a lot in New Mexico. He stands by everything he originally said. I did extensive interviews with Bob, and his story is always the same. His story is never inflated, but it doesn't have to be. It's fantastic enough, involving element 115. He said this, of course, a very long time ago when element 15 was not on the horizon, as it is now. Do the two of you, I'm sure you've digested the Lazar story. Do you buy it?
I buy a lot of it. I think his formula, the actual physics, a mathematical formula for how you create 115, which it was never, you know, when he first put his formula out, it didn't exist. They hadn't identified 115 yet, and they were still up in the high 90s.
True.
Uranium and plutonium are up in the high 90s, and then you get to seaborgium, which is, you know, Gwennard Seaborg's particle, and that's up in the 100s. But element 115 did not exist. And when they discovered it at the University of California, Berkeley, Lawrence Livermore, Lawrence Berkeley Lab, it was one of the two. When they created it, it was the formula was almost to a T identical to Lazar's. Now, if he isn't a physicist and a darn good one, I'll be damned. I mean, this guy gave us a formula, and he was right. They made it. But his theory on how the craft were utilizing element 115, I disagree with. I don't believe they're increasing and creating a gravity field in the craft itself.
So you don't believe in the gravity amplifiers?
No, I think what happens is that initially you need a huge energy burst to affect a lot of mass. And then when you, just like John is using, he uses a lot of static electricity energy, which is ultra-low frequency energy.
That's right, yes.
Almost unmeasurable in a wave sense. And then he starts applying a mid-range frequency and then a higher frequency. That's what John is doing.
Very quickly, John, I'd like to understand. The effect once underway, once you've kicked it off with a lot of RF field at low-frequency electrostatic half-million volts, whatever it is you're using, once you get this effect underway, how long after you have stopped the energy does the effect continue?
Well, it after all the machines are shut down.
Yes.
There's certain metal samples that tend to keep on changing, and on a very rare occasion, it was measured by the Max Planck Institute by Roland Brito and Bruno Bachmann, and it seems that the metal samples are going ahead in time a little bit.
Going ahead in time?
Going ahead in time. They're constantly changing their crystalline structures.
And this goes on for how long?
As far as I know, for years.
For years.
I have one sample here downstairs, and it seems that it's a stainless steel sample. One part of it is magnetic at one end.
Yes.
And it seems to be rotting away. And I can only go by my own calculations, perhaps a piece of stainless steel sitting around.
Rotting away.
Yeah. Yeah. It's flaking apart, breaking down, and actually rusting. And it seems to me that it could be every year that I've had this sample, that perhaps it's 50 years onto 1 year.
All right. This is again jumping off the cliff a little bit, but
yeah.
John, you've been producing this effect and experimenting now for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever considered the fact that you're also experimenting on yourself? In other words, you're within these fields many times. Have you considered the effect on your own biology?
I am into life extension research, and the scientists that I worked with, and we've given many presentations and lectures, we're all very healthy.
Uh-huh.
My partner, George Hathaway, is writing a book on yours truly and his adventures with me. And that's why we're trying to get the Canadian government to release the videos taken at the time of 1986. But it appears I'm in excellent health. I am a quite energetic person, and no ill effects to anybody except people that...
But you spent a lot of time in those fields.
Oh, I did, and especially in the 1980s. And occasionally since 2000, doing some of those demos for Fox TV and TLC and that.
Any lingering effect on you, personally?
The only thing I ever had, Art, was, around 82, I had what I called radar clicks, like little shocks in my head.
Yes.
And I actually had to phone my doctor, and he said, well, knowing what you're doing, I wouldn't worry about it. Then I mentioned George Hathaway, and George says, George always talks about these things. But it's like every few seconds I get a little, like, a shock.
Uh-huh.
It was quite disturbing. I could move around okay, but, it was quite disconcerting, and then after about a week or so of that, it disappeared.
Very unusual.
I haven't grown any, like, six fingers or...
didn't Tesla expose himself to a lot of those fields?
I would certainly imagine that, too.
I feel addicted, though.
Addicted to the effect?
I like to put my hand by the sparks from the Tesla coils.
You do?
I feel it feels good to me. That sounds crazy. It's like...
Yes, a little bit, John.
You know me. But, yeah, something
right?
like that.
Yeah, pretty much like that, actually. What, about a 500,000 volts?
The thimble on my finger, of course, did not get burnt. I just felt that it felt good. And
you're not concerned that one of these days you're going to plop into a different dimension as a result of all this?
I think it'd be an adventure.
That it would.
It doesn't scare me. I mean, I'm not scared of death or anything like that, and to go into another dimension, so be it. But I try and, behave myself and keep the wishes of the mayor of New Westminster hit.
Well, I don't know if this will surprise you or not, John, but there aren't too many people who enjoy doing that to themselves.
With a spark?
Yes. Not too many of them.
Actually, there's a photo of a gentleman sitting on a massive insulator holding a rod, what looks like a, with a broom on the end of it, with sparks flying off of it. He literally charged himself up.
I didn't say that there were not...
Well,
other unusual people out there, John. I simply said there aren't too many who share that particular form of entertainment.
I got you, Art. Yeah. What can I say? I'm different. And I love it. No complaints here.
All right. So, do we not go after UFOs because they're ours, or because we've made a deal, David?
Well, that's interesting. I saw again these. Digital home, digital cameras, people downloading their pictures when they get home. I saw this one on your site recently that shows this guy took a picture amongst a bunch of geese or birds, and there's this UFO with a long arm towing what appears to be a cargo container, which is, of course, not aerodynamic in shape. Obviously, they're not using aerodynamic principles. They're using anti-gravity. I just imagine these guys are hauling, minerals and possibly, a lot of things that interest them from our planet up onto their mothership. So, and Dan Aykroyd made that proposition that maybe we made a deal in exchange for minerals and certain things that they're interested in our planet for technology. And we might be exchanging ideas like that.
Well, of course, Colonel Corso disseminated technology, supposedly, from the Roswell crash.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can imagine that those in charge of everything, if there really are such people, would be very interested in a sort of a trade that might involve what you're talking about, minerals and such for technology. You really think that's underway?
I think when I saw that photo on your site, I mean, it just looked like it. It looked like cargo being, moved out and to and from the planet. But, you know, looking what John just said about time dilations on certain, you know, effects from the Hutchison effect.
Yes.
Go to Roswell for a minute and remember that Trinity, the first nuclear bomb, was tested on July 5th, sometime between the 5th and the 9th. You get different dates depending on where you go. 1945, that was the first bomb. Now,
right.
Imagine these craft are hovering around, you know, wondering what these humans are doing. This is a huge scientific experiment. And they're vibrating up in the gamma spectrum or ultraviolet spectrum, as I propose, and they have low-mass craft, and they're invisible. When you detonate a nuclear bomb, you get an intense burst of gammas and all sorts of different other types of radioactivity. And in higher frequency dimensions, time is slowed down. In lower frequency dimensions, time accelerates. In Einstein physics, also, when you accelerate towards the speed of light, time slows down. And when you slow down, time accelerates relative to that. So time is not a constant. It can be quantified depending on frequency or velocity.
So, David, are you suggesting that we detonated an atomic weapon and brought one of their craft down or more?
Strangely, on either side of Trinity, slightly to the northwest, you have a UFO crash, same dates, plains of St. Augustine, and then you have Roswell just to the southeast of that.
True.
On either side of Trinity, and Roswell crash is 2 years later, July 7th through the 9th, 1947. Now, is it possible that the intense gamma burst, because when two wavelengths collide that are similar frequencies, they affect each other.
Mm-hmm.
But if a gamma wave crosses a low frequency waveform, it just passes right through it. So I think that is their weakness. I think high-frequency waves and lasers in those frequencies distort their craft. I mean, I can't imagine technology that advanced crashing. I mean, you go from one end of the galaxy to the other, or one end of one star system to another, and you can't fly straight when you're down on the Earth and you crash. But an intense gamma burst would, in a higher-frequency dimension, may have distorted their craft, and they both crashed on, imagine the intensity of the explosion on both sides of Trinity, you have UFO crashes. It's very peculiar to me. I'm not saying I know that for a fact, but when you look at the physics of that possibility and what John just talked about, time dilation, when he's seeing particles moving forward in time, and that also means you can move backward in time, that gets really interesting around Roswell.
David, what would you say to John's detractors, those who keep saying it can't be replicated, it's not real, it's all baloney? What do you say?
That's the ultimate question. I believe that the physics is there. I think what John stated is true. He needs better equipment, a far better lab, and much more precise wave measuring devices to actually study and see the wave state of matter as it's transforming and as it goes into levitation.
Again, John Hutchison and David Sirita. Gentlemen, welcome back. I believe that there is a disagreement. I know you wrote a paper, David, on the physics of UFO propulsion reducing the mass gravity effect, and there may be an area here where the two of you sort of disagree on how UFOs move. Is that true?
I don't know if there is.
Well, is there? Let's find out. John, as the man who discovered the Hutchison effect, is it the way they move? Is it the way they reduce the gravity effect? Is that how these objects move? Do you believe?
I do believe, yes, in a way. Because when you consider a very heavy craft and you shield the gravity, like gravity, you need the whole Earth to make something weigh something. And I feel that if you have this type of equipment, you can actually reduce or shield off the gravity pull. There's certain barium compounds or ceramics that seem to do that just a tiny bit. But I feel that inertia can be overcome, where you can do incredible speeds, and also that you can, let's say, turn 90 degrees at high velocity and not feel anything.
And not feel anything, all right.
Really, I mean, when it gets into the mathematics, don't forget that I'm very visual with machinery. And when it gets into the mathematics of things, I cannot comprehend math models.
Why?
I can visualize the atomics.
Yeah, I understand, John. You're a tinkerer, an experimenter, a man, hands-on, real machine kind of guy, and not a theoretical physicist. David, do you agree with this?
Yeah, the way I look at John is he's like an intuitive genius. I mean,
yes.
He intuited this stuff, and that's why, you know, I've worked for a major physicist my whole life and been on a fly in the wall and have read everything under this, everything I can get my hands on, and I believe Dirac's equation in the sea of negative energy is probably the most profound quantum physics paper of our time. And
Tesla the same kind of man?
Yes, I think
who intuited a lot of what he invented.
He wrote a paper on a unified field theory that was not very popular, but Einstein apparently read it and said it was beyond his ability. Whether it was beyond Einstein's ability or he just didn't understand it, it was a unified field theory, and now the theory of everything or unified field theory is what we are seeking, which essentially is a theory that unifies all the four major nuclear forces, the strong forces and the weak forces, into one. And to merge electromagnetism and gravity into a single theory was a desire in Einstein's time, but no one could prove how to do it. Does matter have an electromagnetic charge on it? And Einstein basically said no, because it's basically dead. You have a proton and antiproton pair canceling each other out, an electron anti-electron pair canceling each other out, so the overall charge is zero. But I found if you put it on a full four-dimensional model, they don't cancel each other out to zero. There is a differential between them that is so tiny and so weak, it's very easy to miss it. But I predict that very weak differential between particle-antiparticle pairs, which you can't really see when I'm talking on a radio show, but on paper, in my paper, I demonstrate where it is. I believe that is the particle that everyone's looking for right now, which is called the graviton. We haven't found it.
David, is there enough evidence with regard to John's work to justify, some agency, the military perhaps, or DARPA, somebody to come in with money and fund this man and see what he produces?
I think we should put together a whole team. You know, John, myself, and, you know, big, hot, you know, top NASA physicists and engineers. And when I proposed that to John Schussler and also to Alan Holt at NASA, they agreed. They said, we would love to be spending money on stuff like this at NASA, but we can't get the money under the current administration. But in the black area, I believe that we are actually making a mistake in a national security sense for the risk that another country could figure this out first. And that means we lose air superiority. I mean, if you can fly craft like this and make right-angle turns at 1,000 miles an hour, and
that's right,
you're going to, F-18s are going to be obsolete. The B-2 bomber, the stealth, is going to be obsolete. And if we really don't have this stuff yet, and someone else does...
How much evidence is there that others are working in this area?
Well, I have found, there in the IndiaNet Daily, there's this defense contractor there that's studying UFOs. How far they've gotten in duplicating anti-gravity, I don't know. The only reports in physics journals today are only the repulsive gravity effect, where you have two positive charges or negative charges repelling each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's not real anti-gravity. Hutchison, to me, all the evidence of years that I've spent in the UFO phenomena point to that John's work is the most close, that most closely resembles what I'm seeing in the wave transforming in UFO cases.
Mm-hmm.
And that we should be spending a fortune on it. We should be building a $100 million lab. And I approached, you know, guys like Joe Firmage, who sold U.S. Webb for $1 billion, and you know, not a word out of him. I mean, I've talked to him on the phone, can't get him to do anything. So then you got to go, well, if the free-thinking billionaires like, you know, Bill Gates and Paul Allen are too scared to put money in high-risk stuff like this, then our government should, and that would be DARPA, and different levels of the military, the Air Force, and you just find
all right.
The
what
same
it comes
story.
Down to with DARPA and people like that is, they say, okay, prove it, and
what?
They want you to set up a demonstration, and
yep.
they want to see it before they open their wallets. They will open their wallets, but they want proof.
They want proof, but they also will do it if Lockheed Martin approaches DARPA and says, I want a contract to do the Hutchinson effect. If SAIC does it, if they request the money, but if John Hutchinson and I request the money, we're going to get...
I understand.
Well, I don't know. So it's basically our job to convince the defense contractors to apply for a contract to get into this stuff, and that is kind of what I've started.
Yeah, I was going to say, David, you're a smart guy. How do you go about proving John's work to anybody at all, any middle person even?
Trying to show it on paper, and this paper is kind of, for me, was a landmark because I finally got it down on paper, and I'd be glad to send it to you if you want to read it, and it really does show the feasibility of this actually happening, and the Hutchinson effect is instrumental. Now,
all right, again, it's a 50-page paper on the propulsion and physics of UFOs,
yep,
reducing the mass gravity effect, right?
That and breaking the speed of light and beyond, and also it involves, you know, advanced telecommunications, being able to look at light waves much higher frequency than we're looking at today with new types of Tesla coils. There's a lot of things in the paper, including invisibility, you know, how to make mass go invisible.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe it's going to happen. I mean, what I was told is to be patient, you know, wait for an administration that does want to spend money on exotic research. I mean, that's why America has all the great scientists came from Europe to come here, including Tesla, to do their work, because in their countries, no one would fund them. The Avro Arrow story, which is a very famous story in Canada, Avro Arrow Corporation was doing almost Mach 2 in real F-wing fighter planes before we did here in the United States. The Diefenbaker dismantled the program, and all of the engineers got hired by Boeing and NASA. They were all Canadian engineers who developed the first F-wing fighter planes here in America and started doing Mach 1.5 and approaching Mach 2. And I think John Hutchinson is really an intuitive genius, and he should be put in a lab with, like he said, he doesn't do the math, but he has proven on an experimental model that this is worth pursuing.
And more interestingly, he actually builds these things. That's, I think, the fascinating thing about John.
That's better than physics on paper, and now that he's proved it, even if it doesn't work every time, find out why. Do tests and spend money on it and put them in a lab. And when I put that idea forward to John Schussler, who worked at Boeing and NASA his whole life, and also these new guys over there, they're up for it. They just can't get the money out of, you know, NASA can't get money.
Well, I can certainly tell you that if you could make a piece of metal invisible, mm-hmm, if you could disintegrate a piece of metal, mm-hmm, either way, and you could prove that, and you could show that, you would be funded to the hilt.
You ultimate stealth technology is to make mass invisible, not
absolutely
just invisible to radar.
Absolutely.
But it's slow. It's like people will see a videotape and they won't believe it. And
that's
then
right.
Will they get in their car or take a trip and come to John's lab? His lab is crammed into an apartment.
I know. But here's the important question. If they do come to John's lab for a demonstration, are they going to walk away saying, I just saw it with my own eyes?
Oh, I think they will if they spend enough time there, for sure. Again, do we want to just turn a blind eye to something that could mean the loss of air superiority for the United States? It's not worth it. There's too much point into saying, spend 2 months if you have to up there to study it. I mean, spend the time, spend the money, don't look at it superficially, don't breeze by this. It's not worth losing this position. I don't want to see us lose it. I don't want to see Islamic countries with this kind of technology. I mean, we'll lose our freedom. We won't be able to believe in God or not believe in God, be an atheist or be a Christian or a Buddhist or you know,
well,
Jewish.
Let me ask you this.
Freedom is the greatest thing in the world.
Yes, it is. And let me ask you this. Why do you think that our country, you referenced this administration, but why do you think America is, I don't know, kind of on pause with regard to its space program, with regard to the kind of research we're talking about tonight? All of this, we're kind of on pause. What happened?
Well, I really should ask these questions to some of the people I know who are frustrated the same, because there are scientists at NASA who want to spend money on this themselves, and they have their own advanced concept for propulsion, and they can't get funding. It's a mistake. It has to do with Congress not... I mean, John Kerry didn't even have a good energy strategy. He didn't even do, he didn't get in the field and research what's happening with solar power and new breakthroughs in hydrogen fuel cells. He didn't get in the field and crawl on the ground and say, I've done my homework and here's the energy strategy. Congress is the same. They're not spending time getting to know what scientists are up to.
Mm.
We've got geniuses, stacks of them in this country who have amazing ideas,
and you're
not
think,
getting any money.
And you think John here is one of them.
I believe that. And that's why I just, you know, we decided to do this show together, because I believe all of the evidence points to John's work being so important. It's equal to the Avro Arrow story in Canada. I mean, the next big revolution in aerospace is anti-gravity, and no one, even whether it's accidental or not, or if he can't do it 100% of the time, no one can do anything like this. There's no one on the planet. There's no lab on the planet unless we are proposing that in Area 51 and these, you know, black project areas, they truly have mastered anti-gravity, and then they're not worried. They look at John and they go, well, we've already done it, and, you know.
It's kind of like cold fusion. I mean, mm-hmm. Hans and Fleischmann, they couldn't get funding here. They had to end up going to Europe.
Isn't that? That is so, to me, it disgusts me that we are losing the pioneering spirit that this country was built on.
Well, maybe John should be in Europe.
Well,
have you thought about it, John?
I lived in Europe for 2 years, met a lot of scientists. That's how I was mentioning the Max Planck's group and the Fraunhofer labs. And they were willing to fund things, but things got political.
Huh.
And I returned to Canada here to find that my entire lab, like I wasn't always in an apartment, I always had the industrial sites.
They sacked your lab, didn't they?
They sacked the whole thing, and it was the Canadian government. See, what happened with the Canadian government's visit is that they basically semi-classified it. When I tried to pursue for getting all the tapes and that, they said, well, this is a matter of national security. The Canadian Security Intelligence Service will be looking into my situation.
You were told that, or do you actually have that on paper?
Yes, I do.
You do?
I have all this stuff on paper.
And you've seen that, David?
Yeah, I've seen all the letters and I've read them. I had a whole file of them. I had photocopies. And, you know, to me, Canada, I mean, these guys up there, I mean, the Avro Arrow story, Prime Minister Diefenbaker, they were doing over Mach 2, and he dismantled all the planes because the Americans told him that they weren't interested in doing Mach 2 because we had missiles. He destroys the whole program, destroys all the airplanes that were built up there, and then all the engineers get hired by Boeing and NASA down here, and they revolutionize aerospace.
Yeah.
John should be swallowed by the Canadian government right now. But no one up there, you know.
No, I mean, it's like
they're taking the back seat.
NASA approached me some months ago, and it was the Kennedy Space Center, Duke Follenstein, forgive me for mentioning her name, but they were having a meeting after seeing my videos, and they said that, well, the director felt that at this point we have to focus on other projects. Basically, they just didn't seem to have the funds.
Mm-hmm.
And now,
but part of that, John,
mm-hmm.
Being honest, comes from this irregular ability to repeat your experiments, just like Pons and Fleischmann, really.
I was able to produce it for Fox Television, for Griffin Film Productions, Peter Puttkamer.
That's impressive.
I've done it for CTV News. For many film people over the years, it's just, how can you say it? It's like it's blocked somehow.
Blocked?
Blocked. I don't know if it's on a higher level or maybe it's my own way I look. You know, I'm not in a business suit. I don't keep notes. I'm always...
I understand. You're...
You know, they say, well, John, you don't keep notes and you... And I said, well, it takes the fun out of what I'm doing. I'm sorry, I'm just...
It so difficult for people from official agencies that live on tracked paperwork and all that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
To get anything from you. That doesn't mean what you're doing doesn't have value or isn't real. It's just that without documentation, they have nowhere to go. They're oriented that way completely. They're bureaucrats.
They are. Well, that's why some of the scientists I know, they understand my situation, and they perform the tests and write up documents and papers.
I guess, David, this may be where you can help John out. John is working at one level, but that's sort of a dimension away from the people that actually could jump in and help, right?
Yeah, I mean, I really believe it doesn't matter if he can't reproduce it every time. Some of the earliest scientific breakthroughs we ever had in history, including radio, couldn't be duplicated every time in the beginning until we perfected it. That's why he needs a team around him. He needs top scientists, top physicists, and engineers working with him and in doing this on a very large scale. And I think that is just a tragic mistake to not do it in the Western world. I mean, it is really tragic.
So somehow,
and we will pay the price. If we lose air superiority, we will pay the price.
We almost
had that happen in 1997 through the good graces of Prince Hans Adam Liechtenstein that was to fund me and some scientists down in Bodega Bay to set up a massive laboratory where the scientists could come in and study the effects. But unfortunately, due to the letters from Prince Hans Adam, nothing ever came in. No money ever came this way except endless letters and Christmas cards.
All right, John. Well, you do what you do, and you do it very well. And, David, I think you can be of great assistance to John by perhaps helping to get some scientists who can do enough documentation to properly present to those who would open their wallets.
Yeah, that would be good.
That's what you're trying?
I'm in constant contact with John, and whenever a door opens for me, I try to find a way in there, and I'm always talking to these people and trying to convince them. But I haven't seen, I've even been approached in UFO conferences that by people who claim to be multimillionaires, and they're going to give me money, and they never do.
You two, I can only wish you both well, John.
Yes,
in
sir.
your endeavors, I wish you well, and David, thank you for helping out.
Thank you, Art. It's been a pleasure.